This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. An exhibit now on display at the Cincinnati Art Museum, Human Altered Landscape, celebrates the influence of a generation of photographers who during the 1960s and 70s created a new kind of landscape photography. Several of these artists were featured in a 1975 exhibition, New Topographics, at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York. Human Altered Landscape combines the works of artists from that 1975 show with those of current photographers who were influenced by the 1970s photos. And joining us to talk about the exhibit are photographer Lucas Foglia and Brian Scholes, who's Associate Curator of Photography at the Cincinnati Art Museum. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Brian and Lucas, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Brian, give me some examples of the photos that are being shown in the display, Human Altered Landscapes.
That exhibition, New Topographic, I'll start with the predecessor show in 1975. It's the 40th anniversary, and it contained many of the photographers that I've come to love since becoming involved with photography 15 years ago. We have in the exhibition photographs by Robert Adams, who is currently based in Oregon and is an eminent figure in the field of photography. Louis Baltz, who passed away last year but was equally influential. A German couple, Bernd and Hilla Bescher, who have trained at the art school in Dusseldorf, Germany, a generation of well-known art photographers. As well as Stephen Shore, who was a pioneer of color photography, one of the first artists to really begin using color film at a time when black and white reigned and when color photography was deemed more suitable for advertising or promotional photography. So those artists' work is in the Art Museum collection, and I wanted to celebrate those photographers whose work I love, but also to bring in younger voices who, while maybe not deliberately acknowledging the influence, nonetheless, I feel that there are connections between what they're doing today and what these artists were doing in the late 60s and the early 1970s.
So it's about a 50-50 split between the original exhibit and the current exhibit?
Just about, yes.
Now, tell us the story behind that 1975 exhibit that was the basis for the current one.
Well, it was organized by a curator named William Jenkins with the help of a photographer named Joe Deal, who worked at what today we call the George Eastman House. It's a prominent photography museum in Rochester, New York. And there was this moment in the late 60s and early 70s when a remarkable generation of American photographers independently began renewing their relationship with and looking anew at the American landscape. And they knew each other a little bit, but were all sort of charting their own courses. And it really took this exhibition in 1975 to bring them together and to show the art world that indeed there was something really coherent taking place. That show became so influential that it's now a shorthand for a whole visual style. We now say New Topographics, and those of us in the field, us photography nerds, know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, it was so influential that the show was recreated and sent in 1981 on display in England. And then in 2009, it was recreated again, and it traveled to about five different museums in North America and two more in Europe. And really, the question at heart in that earlier exhibition was the idea of a kind of stylistic anonymity. As the title suggests, New Topographics, the term topography, map making, it's almost as if these artists are scientists robotically covering the American West and taking pictures without a kind of visual style of their own. And that was the sort of overarching impulse behind William Jenkins's original exhibition. We've now learned over four decades that, in fact, all of those artists in that show indeed had their own individual styles. It just took us time to distinguish among them. And we now think of, Robert Adams as somebody who's has a very romantic, capital R romantic attachment to the landscape, whereas somebody like Henry Wessel, another photographer who's influential in the Bay Area where Lucas Foglia lives, I think of him as a little bit more wry and a little bit funnier.
Now, weren't they, it definitely left a legacy. It's had an impact on future photographers. But weren't the original group disappointed in how things turned out?
I'm not sure if they were disappointed in how things turned out as much as the show itself was
received. Maybe they were their own worst critics, maybe?
I think that's true. I think that the show was received very flatly. This was a new type of landscape photography, and what they were showing was not necessarily what we would think of. If you go to other galleries in the Cincinnati Art Museum before looking at this exhibition, you'll see paintings from the 17th and 18th and 19th century of beautiful grand landscapes or maybe intimate views of a forest or a glen or something like that. These are images that are not populated by people, or perhaps there's one lone figure there to admire the natural beauty untouched or unspoiled by human interference. What these photographers began looking at were suburban subdivisions and vernacular signage of businesses and the places where you could not avoid the human impact on the landscape. What influenced them to begin taking these pictures is, still up for debate, whether they were aware of a nascent environmental movement, whether it was just them attempting to reflect upon American post-war prosperity and the growth of an economy that reached into all corners of the continental United States. People still discuss that. But the photographs themselves were surprising, if not shocking, to an audience in 1975. They weren't conventionally beautiful. It's only in retrospect now, looking back on them from the vantage point of four decades later, that we feel we can again, see the individual styles of the photographers and appreciate what they were doing aesthetically.
And they, at the time, they were probably too gritty and too realistic for the audiences.
Something like that, yeah. And I think any photographer, and maybe Lucas can speak to this as well, with regard to peers that he interacts with today, any photographer is both excited by and also a little bit skeptical of being grouped in with another, you know, with another photographer. You know, you want to avoid labels because you're charting your own individual artistic path. But at the same time, for curators like myself and for a general public, it becomes helpful to sort of see movements develop and groups of photographers kind of coalesce.
Lucas?
I think it's also notable that whether a photographer today, like myself, continues in a path of new topographic, what that show did was expand where art could be, where a photographer could look to make a photograph, that especially regarding people and nature, the world that was rendered didn't have to be pristine. You know, so today, photographer friends of mine in the Bay Area or across the world can make work about themselves, about a place, about a landscape, and it's an open choice. It doesn't feel predetermined by any notion of where beauty is.
Lucas, so this is definitely different from what you would see with somebody like Ansel Adams, who was doing the traditional form of landscape photography. But do you think there's a common thread between this contemporary version of landscape photography and the type that Adams did, at least in terms of the message that they're trying to convey?
I think Ansel Adams was an activist. He was trying to photograph nature in a pristine way and argue for its preservation or conservation. The new topographic photographers, for the most part, were showing people in a landscape with a critical eye, but part of their aesthetic was in the critical and the critique. So I think there's a connection and also a reaction. I mean, Ansel Adams was part of a group of photographers that responded to the tradition of painting and portrayals of landscape by continuing it. And the new topographics tried to subvert that and change it.
Tell me about the photos that you took, Lucas, that are featured in Human Altered Landscapes. These are pictures from Front Country, right?
Yes. I photographed for 7 years in the rural American West, starting in 2006, and went there expecting to find cowboys, ghost towns, and wilderness. I'd grown up in New York. When I first went to visit a friend in Wyoming, the landscape felt bigger and harsher than anything I'd ever experienced. And I did find and photograph cowboys and ghost towns and wild space. But at the same time, everyone I met was talking about how unreal the economy was as it was booming in gold mining and natural gas and oil extraction, coal, etc. So in the end, the photo project for me became about showing the same landscape in two different ways, in two different economies. One about what the region was famous for in terms of its agriculture and its wilderness, and the second in terms of a new industry that was transforming the landscape.
Another thing that I would also add is that Lucas is right in that new topographic photographers kind of opened a different part of the world to photography and allowed artists to go out and explore different types of spaces. One thing that I think distinguishes his work from theirs or from a current generation of artists from theirs is that he's also very interested in the human story. And it's funny that we're speaking on public radio because isn't it a public radio reporter who first brought you to Wyoming, a friend of yours,
yeah.
and who first sort of introduced you to the stories that are tied to the pictures that are in Front Country?
Addie Goss was working at Wyoming Public Radio, and then Molly Messick, also who worked at this radio station, introduced me to almost everyone I photographed. And the thing that struck me about New Topographic is it always felt like a sharp eye from a distance. Like Hank Wessel's photographs are incidents of things happening around him that he catches on film, and Robert Adams' photographs are meditations of looking at a place quietly for a long time, also at a distance. You know, the people are across the street or walking by. And for me, by meeting people through friends of friends, I'm introduced to stories by people who trust me because I'm introduced to them by other people they trust. And those stories create images that I didn't know I was going to find ahead of time, but feel more like collaborations than things that happen in passing.
Lucas, tell me about some of the people you met along the way when you were doing this project.
So for instance, I was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which is probably a city that most people will have heard of in Wyoming. And I met a number of people through the Bureau of Land Management, who I met through Wyoming Public Radio, in order to photograph wild elk feeding. So the town feed wild elk in wild areas to keep the elk from migrating through the towns and causing property damage. And I was driving one day, and I got a phone call from the judge in town. He said, "You're going to photograph my daughter's birthday party." And I said, I'm not really a birthday party photographer. he said, "Well, you're going to come photograph the birthday party." And I did, and I came. And I photographed a birthday cake and little kids playing. And then at the end of the party, his daughter, Amanda, took a hose and kind of doused herself off with the hose. And the arc of the water over her head mirrored the clouds over the mountains behind her. And it was that photograph that I used in the book and in the exhibitions. So that the images can't come out of the experience of being in a place and of getting to know people by getting to know the place.
Was this is different from most photo projects, isn't it? I mean, what I typically think of is somebody goes in, they snap the pictures pretty quickly, and then they get out. But you were actually spending a lot of time in the communities and with the people who were your subjects.
The interesting thing is that in magazine photography, for instance, most of the time the writing comes first, and then an editor will think through what the pictures should be that will go along with the writing, and assign a photographer to go photograph those pictures. I mean, good editors are always open to surprises, but that's the norm. And for me, in a longer form process of making photographs in a place, I don't know what I'm going to find ahead of time. Now, for instance, one of the photographs in the exhibition that Brian curated is of a man named Roger weightlifting. I met Roger because I wanted to photograph the most dangerous job in that region, and arguably one of the most dangerous jobs in America, which is a welder in a natural gas field.
These
are men who have sparks flying from their work surrounded by pipes that contain natural gas, or flammable gas. So I went and I met Roger, and again through a friend of a friend. And when I got to their office, effectively in the middle of the natural gas field, inside it was filled with weights, and all of the welders who were there were former bodybuilders. So the photograph I have of Roger is him stretching back this huge bar of weights that he's about to lift. And the arc of his body mirrors the arc of the greenhouse that he's in. and he happens to be surrounded by one of the biggest natural gas fields in the country. But that's not in the photograph, and I chose that photograph because that photograph was more memorable.
It's an intimate and remarkable moment, though I have to clarify that, unfortunately, that photograph is not in the exhibition itself. We're very proud to have purchased it for the Art Museum's permanent collection, but we've chosen another of Lucas's photographs to be in the exhibition itself.
Brian, was the 70s exhibit, was that taught later in photography and art schools, or was this just something that photographers came across on their own and said, this is really fascinating and an interesting way of looking at things?
Well, a lot of these photographers are still alive and still working and are more influential now even than they were then. Stephen Shore teaches at Bard College in upstate New York and runs a very influential photography program. I think Henry Wessel, Lucas, maybe you can correct me, I think he's teaching in San Francisco still.
He just recently retired, but the photography world is a small community. So when I first moved to San Francisco after finishing my MFA at Yale, I emailed Henry Wessel, or Hank Wessel, and asked him if he'd be willing to have a coffee. He said, sure, come to the museum. I met him at SF MoMA. We had a coffee, and he told me where to print my photographs and talked about the community. We walked around the show. His map of the community in the Bay Area became a community that I now interact with and am a part of.
Brian, how are the present-day photos and human-altered landscapes, how are they different from the photos from the original exhibit, New Topographics?
It's a good question, because you can look at the original photographs, or I should say the photographs by the artists who are included in the original show. They're not the exact same photographs. And it's an intimate process. They're often 8-by-10-inch black-and-white prints. You stand very close to them, and you peer in at the details. And then if you turn around in 180 degrees on your heels and look across the room, the contemporary prints are not only in color, but they're also often much, much larger. So the photograph of Lucas is 36 by 46 inches, 3 by 4 feet. There are some that are even larger. They also range across the world. And so we have photographs from Africa and from Australia by artists who are from other places. So it's a... In a way, the show offers a kind of miniature lesson in the changes in art photography over the last 40 years. It was, at the time, in the 1960s and the 1970s, people were wonderful darkroom technicians, and they really practiced the skill of making sumptuous black and white gelatin silver prints, often at a small scale. Now there is, equally technically proficient, but the prints are much larger. It's almost like... a much more obvious window onto a particular world. And our exhibition has aerial photographs, including photographs by a Canadian photographer named Edward Bertinsky, who's very influential. You really do get a sense that even though the exhibition is one continuous whole, that there is obviously a change that happens over the course of the 80s and the 90s and into the 2000s.
Now, Human Altered Landscape started in April, and what kind of reaction have you been getting from people who've come in to view it?
Well, I'm a particular fan of landscape photography, and first and foremost, I was just eager to get out onto the wall some photographs from the Art Museum's collection that haven't been seen before or haven't been seen in decades, if there are things that we've owned for a long time. And when I say owned, I mean held in trust for the people of Cincinnati. And so the people who've come, who are fans of the museum and who come regularly, they recognize that this is something that they didn't even know we had. This is new for them. And it's been a kind of revelatory experience for them in that regard. And at the same time, we opened the exhibition around the time of Earth Day. And I am not attempting to be politically didactic or to beat anybody over the head, but a lot of these artists are very environmentally aware and are attempting to document changes that are taking place in the environment around them or around the world. And so when I put the exhibition on display, I hung it in such a way as to be able to tell a few stories. And I'll just give one example here. The photograph I mentioned as an aerial picture was taken above a giant copper mining operation in Western Australia. Two pictures away on an adjacent wall is a photograph of an African man on the outskirts of Accra in Ghana, who makes a living by scavenging through an electronics waste recycling dump. It's a big dump full of computers and old iPhones and televisions, and he and other people who are living in poverty there scavenge that material for copper wiring and other materials that they can then sell back and recycle, and that's how they make their living. And so you see in those two pictures two ends of a global production chain that leads to a lot of the electronic products we use. There's a beginning and an end there on the walls in front of you.
And the exhibit's only on display for, what, another week or so?
Until July 19th,
Until July 19th. Well, thank you very much. Photographer Lucas Foglia and Brian Scholes, Associate Curator of Photography at the Cincinnati Art Museum. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier with help from Lizzie Kibler. The technical director was Kevin Rowinski. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on 91.7 WVXU. To be a fan of cable news shows to know liberals and conservatives have very different ways of looking at the world. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll talk about new findings from three different studies that link a person's political ideology to their level of self-control. Also, we'll talk about the history of the All-Star Game and take a look at this year's lineup. That's on Cincinnati Edition, Thursday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.